I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. This week, an interview with Governor Rick Scott. We'll discuss the economic health of Florida, his take on presidential politics, and what the president's jobs plan might mean for the Sunshine State. And later in the program, Key West's magical allure has attracted all kinds of people. But in the 1970s, musicians like Jimmy Buffett and writers like Hunter Thompson and Tennessee Williams all made it their hangout of choice. We'll find out why with author William McKean and his new book, Mile Marker Zero. That's ahead on Intersection. Governor Rick Scott ran for office on a promise of bringing more jobs to the Sunshine State. This week, I talked with Governor Rick Scott about Florida's current job slump as he prepared to attend political events in Orlando. Governor Rick Scott, welcome to Intersection.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Very good, thanks. Governor, you campaigned kind of as the jobs governor, saying you were going to add 700,000 jobs to Florida in 7 years, and those were jobs beyond the yearly prediction of about a million jobs through annual growth in Florida. Recently, though, you had to change that prediction, backtrack on it a little bit, if you will, saying that your goal now 700,000 total jobs created, meaning you're counting jobs that are not solely reliant on your economic policies for creation. Can you tell us about why you made that change?
We didn't. What I talked about during the whole campaign was seven steps to 700,000 jobs over the next 7 years. As you know, the last 3 years we've been losing jobs across the state, and we've had a great year so far. Unemployment's come from 12% down to 10.7. But my plan is over the next 7 years to generate over 700,000 jobs. And this year so far, we've done 87,200 private sector jobs. So the goal is every month just focus on building jobs.
But you did change how you're counting them, yes?
No. Nope. We rely on what the federal government puts out, their unemployment numbers every month. And so we rely on those numbers. But no, my focus all along has been to, you know, where we got started, which was 12% unemployment, to start growing jobs from the minute I came into office.
Can you tell us then, I guess, what has Florida gotten specifically so far, though, under your job growth policies?
Well, what we focused on is the things that give people a reason to do business in Florida. Because, you know, we all have to understand we're competing with China and India and Vietnam and Brazil, Colombia, Panama, countries that 20 years ago, people were not focused on building their businesses. Now they are. So the things that business people think about is, you know, tell me what my taxes are going to be. Tell me what my fees are going to be. What's the regulatory environment? Is it difficult to do business in this state? And then what's my risk of lawsuits? Because when you go to the store as a consumer, you don't think about those things. But a business person has to, because you go to the store and say, look, I'm going to buy my product or my service a lot based on price. And so we've got to put our business people, if we want jobs in this state, in a position that they can compete globally. And we're doing it. We've reduced property taxes this year, over $210 million. We've reduced the business tax for nearly half the business owners that are paying the tax. We're in the process of eliminating over 1,100 regulations that we don't need that are killing jobs rather than doing things that we as citizens of the state need. And we're continuing to focus on lawsuit reform. We did some last year. We're going to continue to work on it every year.
Well, let me ask you about the cutting back property taxes and reducing other fees that are out there for businesses. Don't you eventually cut so far, though, at a certain point, you run the risk of not having enough revenue coming into the state in general to run whatever government services are still out there?
No, what we're focused on is making sure that we have the size of the government we need, but we don't have a size of government more than what we need. We're doing the things that you expect your state government to do, but not to do the things that you don't expect. And, you know, we're in a different economy today. We're not in the world economy is not growing, so we're competing. So we're going to watch how we spend every one of your tax dollars, make sure you're going to get a return on those tax dollars. We're going to make sure we have the safety nets that we expect and want for those that, for example, can't afford health care. We're going to make sure we put the money and to make sure we have continue to keep our lakes and our rivers clean, make sure we have the environment that we want, but we're not going to waste money.
But does Florida need more money?
No, we're going to live within our means. We're going to do exactly what the federal government's not doing. The federal government's borrowing 43 cents of every tax dollar, of every dollar they spend. That's not sustainable. We're going to live within our means, and we're going to grow our state by growing the number of jobs here, not grow our state government by growing taxes.
One thing that you mentioned, growing jobs, you recently announced that 500 new jobs coming to Tampa from Time Warner. And I wonder, what specifically can you say that your policies did to bring Time Warner to Florida, or was this something that was in the works much farther out beyond when you took office?
Sure. As you know, we were competing, I think, with 39 other cities, a variety of other states, Tampa was. And Time Warner made the decision that this was the right state to do business. And the things that they looked at our taxes, or looked at our fees, looked at our regulation, and looked at our attitude towards business people. Part of one of the reasons we're successful right now is that companies know that if they have an issue, we're going to sit down with them and try to solve the issue, rather than have it an attitude that we're going to create more rules and regulations and be difficult to do business with. So I'm really excited that Time Warner's coming. I hope we'll have a lot more announcements like Time Warner. But it's 500 new jobs for Floridians, and I'm excited about that.
You've got a legislative session coming up in January. That's two for you now in less than a year's time. And as we tape this conversation, it's right before some of the committee meetings are getting ready to start. What's going to be your top legislative priority going into January?
Well, I'm going to be putting out my legislative agenda after P5 this weekend, so I'll be coming out in the next week or so with my agenda. But really, it's tied to three things. As you know, I grew up living in public housing, it's very, very important. I know it's very important that we keep the cost of living as low as we can in the state. Two, I had the opportunity to get a good education. I want to make sure our kids have the opportunity to get a great education. And three, from a young age, I was able to get a job. Didn't pay a lot in the beginning. I paid a penny to deliver papers, worked as an 85-cent-an-hour fry cook. But I want to make sure everybody in Florida that wants a job has the opportunity to get a job.
How are you going to communicate better with the leadership of the two chambers? I remember during the last year, House Speaker Dean Cannon found out about your rejection of high-speed rail money by reading the papers, which didn't sit very well. So what's going to be different this year in terms of communicating with the leadership?
Well, I spent a lot of time working with leadership of both the House and the Senate. And talk about their priorities and my priorities. The nice thing is Speaker Cannon, President Herodopoulos, they have the same goals. They know that the biggest issue we have in the state is we need jobs. They know we've got to live within our means. They know we don't want to incur more debt in the state. One thing great that happened this year is that, in contrast to what's happened federally, we were able to get our negative outlook to remove to have a stable outlook on our debt. And so those are the things we're working on. I'm working very well with Speaker Cannon and President Herodopoulos.
You mentioned wanting to create jobs. Of course, at the federal level, President Obama unveiled his $450 billion jobs plan that includes about $7.5 billion for schools, roads, other projects. Would you accept that federal money if the proposal is passed by Congress?
Well, I look forward to looking at it. All the federal programs, there's always strings attached. But as we all know, those are our dollars. They go up there. They come back with strings. But I look forward to seeing what they're going to come back with, and see if it makes sense for Florida. If the president wanted right now to create jobs, what he would do is he would send the three free trade agreements to Congress and get those ratified for Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. Those would generate thousands of private sector jobs in Florida and around the country. So that's what I'd like him to do right now.
What's an acceptable string to be attached to federal money, and what's not an acceptable string to be attached to federal money?
Well, I think what you have to look at on all the federal money, we always have to remember that's our money that we send to them. And historically, Florida has been so-called a donor state. We send way more money to the federal government than they send back. But does it fit within what we're trying to accomplish in the state? Or is it going to create a program that ultimately is going to require taxes to go up? So if it fits with what we want to accomplish for Floridians, then we'll be interested in looking at it. If all it's going to do is create a program that we never had an interest in creating in Florida, and then they're going to have the expectation that we continue it after they stop the funding, then we won't be doing those type of programs.
Do you think that because Florida has that reputation of being a donor state, that if you reject this money, does Florida lose something then? Or do you fulfill that prophecy then, if you reject it, of making Florida stay in that donor state status?
Well, I'm going to be focused on doing what's right for Floridians and making sure that the money that we take is money that fits within our needs. As you know, for example, we need to expand our ports. It's a big opportunity for Florida. We should be a significant shipping capital for the world. With the expansion of the Panama Canal, our ports need dollars for dredge and things like that. We need to work on our cargo rail infrastructure. So there's a lot of great programs that they could help us with, and I hope with the support of Chairman Mica that those are the types of things that will happen.
Governor, of course, many top GOP leaders, including yourself, in Central Florida, as we tape this interview for the Presidency 5 events. Who are you leaning towards supporting for the presidential nomination for the GOP?
Well, I haven't made a decision to endorse a candidate yet, but this is a very significant event on Saturday with the P5. The last three straw polls that have happened in Florida, the winner of that straw poll has gone on to win the Republican nomination. Reagan did in 79, George H.W. Bush did in 1987, and Bob Dole did in 95. So it's a very significant event, and I look forward to listening to all the candidates talk about what they bring to the table. I think the candidate's going to win is the candidate that has the best plan for job creation. That's clearly the biggest issue we're dealing with in Florida.
Would you accept a vice presidential slot if it was offered?
No, my focus is Florida. I love living in Florida. I love working on trying to improve the lives of all Floridians.
And, of course, there's also going to be a U.S. Senate debate. Are you favoring any candidate in that race?
No, again, I think the winner is going to be who's going to help us balance our budget, spend our money better, and get our country back to work.
You know, just out in the papers the other day, Workforce Central Florida, the board, you have asked for them to be sacked. There's a long list of misusing funds brought against the agency. CEO Gary Earle is disputing claims of those misdeeds and said in a recent interview it looked like political grandstanding coming from the governor's office in Tallahassee. How do you respond to that?
Well, what I ran on is a campaign of accountability, getting our state back to work. Those dollars are supposed to be spent helping people get back to work, not spent on things that have nothing to do with job creation. So I've asked for the leadership team there to be replaced. I want the board replaced. I want there to be more transparency, more accountability, because I want those dollars, which are your dollars, I want those dollars to be spent helping people get jobs.
Any particular person you might have in mind to head the agency later on?
Well, it's chosen locally, but we have, if they would like our support, we have our Department of Economic Opportunity would be glad to be helpful to them.
Floridians on the Space Coast in the middle of their own economic downturn right now with the retirement of the shuttle program. Of course, recently a long-range vision for a brand-new rocket was announced, but I wonder, what are you planning to do right now to help retain any of the highly skilled workforce that is out of work right now on the Space Coast?
Well, I think the Space Coast is a significant opportunity for Florida. We have such unbelievable talent there. And so what's going to happen is there's going to be a lot of new companies started. There's a lot of companies interested in moving there because of all that talent. I did a trade mission, as you know, in June up to Canada. And a lot of companies, especially in Toronto that I sat down with, are very interested in expanding in the Space Coast area because of the talent pool we have there. We're also going to work on making sure that we continue to do private launches there. And so I think there's a significant opportunity going forward.
Who's better positioned, though, to help the Space Coast right now? Because for so long they've been relying on the federal government. Is the state in a better position to help workers right now who are out of a job?
Well, I think it takes, first off, the local community's got to figure out exactly what they need. And look, government doesn't create jobs. Government creates an environment where private companies create
but
jobs.
But if they have a big rockets program, if they have a big rocket program that's federally funded, Governor, isn't that the federal government creating jobs?
That's federal government spending money, and it creates jobs. But the long term, the real opportunity there is with the private sector.
And so, Governor, is there a priority for the Space Coast this session or anything in the works?
We're working on a lot of things around talking to companies that have an interest in coming to the Space Coast, making sure that this, whether it's regulations or whether it's taxes or whether it's fees, that people want to open their businesses around the Space Coast. I'm also doing a trade mission down to Panama. Down to Brazil in October. There's a lot of aviation that comes out of Brazil. As you know, Embraer opened up a plant there this year to build two of their jets, and I'm hoping that they're going to expand their operations in the Space Coast area.
You recently underwent a public makeover in terms of the way you're reaching out to the public and the press, and that was in the midst of very low poll numbers. But I wonder, you know, have you just changed your outside approach to governing and interacting with the press and the public, or is there something more substantive, further down reaching into the core of how Rick Scott governs that's going on?
Well, the I've had the opportunity this summer with the session getting out to spend more time around the state. It's been great. I enjoy getting around the state and talking to people, listening to their ideas. This is, you know, we have almost 19 million Floridians, and they've got a lot of great ideas. So I pretty much travel almost every day of the week and get around and do events and talk to people about their ideas. And it helps me a lot in figuring out the right way to make decisions for the benefit of all Floridians.
So are you saying that that was something that was lacking in your approach?
This time I've had a lot of time to get around and talk to people. As you know, it's hard during session because you're there. We do policy briefings twice a day and meeting with legislators to try to make sure we have the right bills passed that I feel comfortable signing.
Well, Governor Rick Scott, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Same thing. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. There was a surprise out of the presidential straw poll taken in Orlando at the Presidency 5 events. Atlanta businessman Herman Cain was the victor, coming out ahead of heavily favored Texas Governor Rick Perry. Tell us about who you think should have won online at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. Up next on Intersection, traveling back to Key West of the 1970s. This is 90.7. Key West in the 1970s was a place of extraordinary creativity, talent. It drew writers, musicians, artists, Tennessee Williams, Hunter Thompson, Jimmy Buffett among the names there. William McKean gathers their stories in his latest book, Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. It's due out next week. McKean is chair of the Department of Journalism at Boston University and joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you interested thinking about Key West?
Well, my wife is from Key West, and of course, I've just tons of family there now. But it was a guy that I had worked with on my last book, which is a biography of Hunter Thompson, who said, you know, Hunter really wanted to do a book on Key West in the 70s. And this guy had been there. I said, well, why don't you do it? And he said, I want you to do it. So I was sort of recruited to do the book. And of course, it was a great opportunity for me because I knew I'd be talking to a lot of the people that I've really admired the last 20, 30 years or so, and it was a chance to spend time in Key West. So it's a no-brainer. I had to do it.
So actually going out and talking to the conks who were there in the 70s.
Right. And, of course, a lot of the main characters, the writers and artists that were there in the 70s, have all moved to Montana. So the big trip was actually to Montana, where I stayed in a cabin there for a while and interviewed all of them.
So take us back to Key West in the 1970s. What was it that made it special during that era?
I think it was a kind of a crazy, wide-open town. There was always a history of piracy in the culture. And so it was a culture that was kind of built on all kinds of different vices. I mean, I call it ground zero for lust and greed and just about everything. So, you know, the people that are today the respected business community in Key West actually built those businesses by selling marijuana under the counter. So it was a real laissez-faire town, and they just didn't care about what people did. I mean, it was a very welcoming place for someone like Tennessee Williams, who wasn't, you know, always welcome everywhere else because of his sexuality. It was a welcoming place for kind of weird renegade artists like Tom McGuane and Hunter Thompson. And it was also the inspiration. It was the muse for Jimmy Buffett, because when he came to Key West in 1971, he was a certified failure as a country music singer, and he came there and sort of found whatever it is that makes him Jimmy Buffett, you know, the margarita culture.
So you weave together the stories of these different folks that were down there, but did they actually run in the same circles?
Oh, they did. This is really, when people ask me what the book's about, and I said, that's about these five friends and their friendship over the course of the last four or five decades, and the great art that they've made and the fun that they had. And, you know, all I could say was, after doing a lot of these interviews, I wished that I had been there. I wish I was old enough to have gone through this with these great writers. It's also kind of a story of redemption, because the guy that's the central figure in the book is Thomas McGuane, the novelist. And he was, all the eyes were sort of on him in the early 70s. He was supposed to be the hippie generation's Ernest Hemingway, and he was called the new Hemingway all the time. And he went there and he abused every single drug known to man, became the most raging alcoholic and drug abuser of his generation. And he was known as Captain Berserko. And then one day he just said no more, and he stopped. And 35 years later, he still hasn't touched a drug or a drink. And I was attracted to that story of redemption, because I thought, so many people fall into that spiral. Here's a guy who was absolutely at the bottom, and he got out alive, and is he is living the happy ending.
Well, you mentioned there's one successful happy ending story there, but talk to me a little bit more about the other characters there: Tennessee Williams, Hunter Thompson, Jimmy Buffett. Did they have a similar redemption, or what stood out for you about their stories?
I think they all found that Key West was kind of the most important part of their lives, even to Hunter Thompson. His exile in Key West occurred when he was getting divorced, and everyone in the country, I think, thought he was burned out. This is back in the late 70s, because he wasn't writing anything. And it's because he was having so much fun living and enjoying life and fishing and having a great time. And it was probably, according to his longtime girlfriend, it was the happiest portion of his life. I think there are a lot of people who found their sort of their inner peace there. And I do know for Buffett, it was a tremendously important part of his life for his artistic awakening.
Now, one of the underlying themes in this book is, of course, that Key West has been perceived by so many of the outsiders as a paradise. But you kind of highlight there is and has been a danger element in Key West. And I wonder, can you talk to us about how that weaves between some of these characters?
Well, I do call it a dangerous paradise, because it's a culture that's built on alcohol and drugs, and there's only so much fun a human being can have without going crazy. And I think that a lot of people who stayed there too long, who didn't get out, have suffered from that. And I think it's kind of sad to see some of the old conks going around today, and they're just kind of like alcoholic wrecks. It's a beautiful place to visit, and I do enjoy visiting it. But I've thought a lot about whether I could live there, because my wife is from there. And we talk about it, and she said, you'd never survive. And she always referred to leaving Key West as getting out of Key West. And, you know, she's just happy as a clam, so to speak, living up north, because Key West was a great place to grow up for her. But she knew, if we're going to raise children, this is not the place for them to be, which is the decision Jimmy Buffett makes, too, in the book, is that when he gets married and they start to have a family, he realizes, well, this is no place to raise kids. It's just kind of a, I guess what's good about the culture is that it's very laissez-faire, but what's bad about the culture is that it's so isolated and insular, and you're just really cut off from the rest of the world.
Isn't that interesting, though? So many people on the outside wanting to go there, and the people who are there wanting to get out.
And the town's changed so much, because what I do remember from going there as a kid was, it was just a small town on an island, and it was funky. From doing all my interviews and my research in the 70s, it was kind of the same. It was just this great funky little town. But everyone's been priced out by now. I think what happened in the 90s and in the last decade is that if you live in Key West full-time, you are either homeless or you are a millionaire, and that there is no middle class. And all the people that work in the restaurants and Sloppy Joe's and Hog's Breath, where everyone, all the tourists go, they can't afford to live in Key West, and they drive 30 miles one way to get there from Sugarloaf Key or Big Pine or wherever they live up the Keys.
Well, Bill McKean, your new book, Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West, could you read us a passage?
Sure. I'll read you a little bit about one of the themes in the book, which has to do with drugs, specifically marijuana. Marijuana seeped into the world of white middle-class kids in the 60s as dormitories lit up and the music demanded that everybody must get stoned. The Beatles smoked dope and spoke of it freely. There were other drugs, of course, but by the 70s, LSD, once so hot in the late 60s, had become, in the words of one connoisseur, the Studebaker of the drug market, used only by aging dilettantes. Sure, there was hashish and mescaline and mushrooms and opium here and there, But marijuana was the meat and potatoes of the drug diet in the early 70s, and a lot of it came in through South Florida, especially the Keys. But in the early 70s, there was more tolerance for that sort of thing in Key West. Jimmy Buffett called it an open town of smugglers, shrimpers, and crazies. It was the end of the world. Pot was part of the daily life of Key West. The town drew the arty types, and they needed their inebriants. Ernest Hemingway had his rum and whiskey. Tom McGuane and his friends had those and added marijuana to the mix. Marijuana was everywhere, and the Key West cops, some of them at least, looked the other way. Colombians flew Piper Cubs full of pot to homemade landing strips hacked out of the undergrowth of the lower Keys. Shrimpers took huge loads of it onto the little boats, storing them in the hold with their legitimate haul. Everybody wanted it. In a resort town, it was hard to keep a business going, especially a family business, when tourists were gone half the year. "We got to put food on the table, man." That was the rationale. "What's the harm in selling a little bit under the counter?" Shrimpers doubled their pleasure by filling their boats with pot. They'd deliver loads of commercial American cigarettes to South America and then bring back pot on the return. Dope brought a better price than shrimp. If they were at sea and the feds were closing in, they'd discreetly toss the bales off the boat, away from government eyes. If the feds saw it, there wasn't much they could do, at least nothing that would hold in court. The floating dope was not in the possession of the boat's captain or crew. They called those errant bobbing bales square grouper.
That's William McKean, author of the new book Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. Well, overhanging all of this, and of course the subtitle of your book, The Movable Feast of Key West, is Ernest Hemingway. And there's kind of a parallel between Key West in the 70s and what Hemingway was experiencing in the 20s and 30s down there.
Right. In fact, that was one of the things that drew me to the story, was that I'd read Ernest Hemingway's Movable Feast and had always romanticized that era of all those great writers, you know, sitting around in Paris and thinking great thoughts and so on and so forth. And so here I saw a parallel because, you know, two of the finest writers of my lifetime, I believe, are Thomas McGuane and Jim Harrison. And doing this book and getting to interview them was just a thrill. And now, you know, we've continued to be email buddies since. So I sort of saw the parallel. And it was a different time. I guess we romanticized the 20s in Paris as being much more elegant than Key West in the 70s. In fact, Jim Harrison told me that, "I don't go to Key West anymore. I liked it more when it smelled of fish guts." So he's, you know, I think what attracted them was kind of the low-rent nature of Key West. But there was an awful lot of serious talk about literature coming from these guys in that time. What the book, one of the focal points of the book is how McGuane was so serious about his work. The only thing he would do outside of his work, and of course his family, was to go fishing. That he was almost a literary Boo Radley. They couldn't get him out. He wouldn't go to bars. He wouldn't do this and wouldn't do that. And then one day, something clicked in his head, and he went crazy and became Captain Berserko. And then, you know, as I said earlier, kind of crawled away from that. But, you know, that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, anywhere else. It wouldn't have happened to him in Montana, where he spent the other half of his year each year. So I think there's something about Key West that really brought out the beast in people.
I've been speaking with William McKean. He's author of the new book, Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West, which comes out next week. McKean joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. Bill, good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on.
You can hear more of Mile Marker Zero on our webpage, wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also find links to our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.